Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Stegall versus Okra.
May it please the court, Mr. Stanley Johansson will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal, which will be presented by Mr. Paul Cloak.
May it please the court. I am Stanley Johansson and with co-counsel Paul Cloak and Marianne Faust represent the petitioners, the estate of John Odra and John Odra's daughter and grandchildren. This case involves an A trustee for B bank account, sometimes called a Totten Trust account. This case is different in that there are two A's, that is, there were two trustees on the account. John Odra, who contributed all of the money to the account, and his mother, Stella Odra, who contributed none of the money and who was named on the account as trustee and not as beneficiary. The beneficiaries on the account were John Odra himself and his children and grandchildren. John Odra has died. He was survived by his mother, Stella, and by his children and grandchildren. At issue is, who owns the bank account? This is a case of statutory construction of the multiple party account statutes, sections 436 to 449 of our probate code. The 14th Court of Appeals, in an en banc divided opinion, held that on John Odra's death, the amount on deposit vested in and was beneficially owned by Stella Odra as the surviving trustee. That John Odra's money, placed in an account over which he had exclusive control during lifetime, was beneficially owned by Stella Odra by reason of John's death. The court based its decision on section 438 of our multiple party account statutes, which is captioned ownership during lifetime. Under section 438C, quote, a trust account belongs beneficially to the trustee during his lifetime. And if two or more parties are named as trustee on the account, during their lifetimes, beneficial rights as between them are governed by subsection A. And under subsection A, the account belongs to the parties in proportion to their net contributions. And here it is undisputed that John Odra contributed every dollar to this account.
Why wouldn't subsection C of 439 be the controlling provision?
That is the exact point, Your Honor, because the Court of Appeals majority found from this statute, excuse me, let's go back to 438, the Court of Appeals majority based its decision on this statute that beneficial ownership passed to the surviving trustee, and they did so, here's the Court of Appeals now, by doubling back on that sentence in the middle of 439C. During their lifetimes, when there were two trustees, beneficial ownership was in John Odra. But, said the court, going backward in that same clause, I quote the opinion, quote, after her son's death, she was the trustee under section 438C, and as such was the beneficial owner of the account. However, as Chief Justice Curtis Brown pointed out in his dissenting opinion, and I quote, section 438C does not create a right of survivorship between trustees. Section 438C only governs ownership of the funds when all of the parties to the account are alive.
But, well, I guess my question is not really referring to the Court of Appeals opinion, but 439C says, does it not, that the sums remaining on deposit, if there is any left after the survivor of two or four more trustees goes to beneficiaries?
Here's what section 439C says, Your Honor. It creates a right of survivorship, and I would predicate this by pointing out that this court in Stauffer v. Henderson said that section 439 is the exclusive means of creating survivorship rights in any multiple party account. And in that opinion, this court expressly referred to joint accounts under section 439A, P POD accounts under subsection B and trust accounts under subsection C. And in this case, Your Honor, subsection C creates survivorship rights in two and in only two situations. First, in the normal situation where there is only one trustee, the typical trust account, on the death of the trustee, or here, on the death of the survivor, the last to die of two or more trustees, then and only then does the amount on deposit pass to the beneficiaries. And so, these are the only two provisions in Section 439C that create a right of survivorship. There is no language in the controlling provision, 439C, that by its terms creates a right of survivorship in this case where there was two trustees and one of them has died. But in this situation, the Court of Appeals decision would infer a right of survivorship from the mere fact that we have a trust account with two trustees. What then is the answer? The answer lies, again, looking at Section 439 as the exclusive means of creating rights of survivorship. We go down to the bottom, subsection D, where it says, quote, in other cases, in all other cases, the death of any party to a multiple party account has no effect on beneficial ownership, other than to transfer the rights of the decedent as part of his estate. Subsection A, B, and C describe the circumstances where there is a right of survivorship. In all other multiple party account cases not covered by A, B, or C, there is no right of survivorship. Now, in her reply brief at page 19, respondent has suggested that petitioner's reliance on subsection 439D is, quote, ill-founded, and that section 439D is intended to cover other cases, cases other than those involving joint accounts, POD accounts, and trust accounts. But, Your Honor, that is dead wrong and reflects either a misreading or a misunderstanding of the statutes. Aside from joint accounts, POD accounts, and trust accounts, there are no other cases. There are no other types of bank accounts to which this statutory scheme applies. The definition section, section 436, defines multiple party account as a joint account, a POD account, or a trust account, period. These are the only three types of bank accounts to which these statutes, including subsection D, apply. Okay. And indeed, that's not surprising. Many such accounts exist in Texas. Such an account was before this court in Stauffer v. Henderson, a joint account between Mary Henderson and her sister with no survivorship agreement. And that is why, in Stauffer, this court held that on Mary Henderson's death, the account did not pass by right of survivorship to her sister, but instead became a part of Mary Henderson's estate.
Mr. Johansson, if I understand your position, you're saying in a circumstance where the trust is revocable and the trustee dies and there's a surviving trustee on the account, the heirs of the dying trustee can revoke the trust to the extent of the trustee's whatever beneficial interest, I guess, that the original trustee had.
No, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that this is the statute that governs the rights to a multiple party account on the death of one of the parties to the account. This language does not speak of revocation. Yes, it is true, the signature card in this case did speak of language of revocation. It gave the, quote, grantor the power to revoke. The answer has to be found in the statute.
Well, the statute 39C, doesn't it say, unless an intent is clearly expressed otherwise? So I'm assuming the trust was irrevocable, then we wouldn't be having
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
Your position is that if I and Justice Cornyn put some money into an account for some beneficiaries out there, and then I die, then my heirs have the right to remove my money from that trust account.
Well, more precisely, the personal representative of your estate, because it passes as a part of his estate, it becomes a part of that person's estate. That is correct, Your Honor.
And the only way I can the only way I can, how does that impact normal, if I'm a settlor of a trust and I don't revoke the trust, then how do my heirs end up revoking the trust?
Again, although the signature card made reference to the Texas Trust Act, it must be understood that we're dealing with a distinctive animal here, a multiple party account that happens to be called a trust account. And although it referred to the Texas Trust Act and no doubt intended to impose fiduciary duties, of course, many parts of the Texas Trust Act, now the trust code, could not apply, the investment powers and so on and so on. But the answer here, if I create a revocable trust and retain the power to revoke it, and I do revoke, then of course the money is mine. However, in this situation, although it was called on the back of the signature card a revocable trust, and although it named Stella Odra as grantor, it must be remembered, and it went on to say that Stella Odra as grantor could revoke the trust and withdraw the funds. Two responses. First of all, the power to revoke this account and withdraw the money, that's just like Section 447 of our multiple party statute, which says payment of trust account. It's designed to protect the bank. It's designed to authorize the power to withdraw funds and protect the bank if it pays. But as this court said in Stauffer v. Henderson, such a provision does not establish ownership rights. It merely authorizes the power to withdraw and protects the bank if it pays out pursuant to those instructions. Second point, again, as for Stella Odra being the grantor and the trustee of this, as well as the trustee, but as for Stella being the grantor and having the power to, quote, revoke, I refer you to that old Abraham Lincoln story. Recall Mr. Lincoln asking, if you call a dog's tail a leg, how many legs does a dog have? And recall Mr. Lincoln's answer, four, said Mr. Lincoln. You can call a tail a leg, but that doesn't make it a leg. You can call Stella Odra a grantor, but she was not the grantor of this trust account. Every dollar in this account was contributed by John Odra, and you cannot create a trust with somebody else's money. And so in this case, I would like to refer the court to two key points as far as the statutory scheme here. The answer, as I've indicated, lies in subsection D, but I want to focus on what the Texas legislature did when it enacted the multiple party account statutes in 1979, drawing heavily from the Uniform Probate Code. When you examine the whole scope of the statutes, you will find that they are virtually identical, except in two important respects. And both of these changes are found in section 439, governing succession to ownership when one of the parties to the account dies, and therefore the one section that controls this case, section 439A, dealing with joint accounts.
Counsel, I just received a note that the timer doesn't work.
Oh, goodness.
I'm trying to flash you without success.
Oh, sorry, yes. How so close am I?
Time's expired.
I think it's expired.
Does anybody have a question?
I do have a very impressive closing, Your Honor.
Well, and if you have, if anybody asks a question, they want to hear it.
I was wondering about that.
Is there a question? If you ask a question.
What's your closing?
We'd like to hear your closing in the rebuttal.
Some very good points. I would want to point out to this court, I believe this case has a significance far beyond its importance to the parties, as important as that is. The practical effect of the lower court decision, if allowed to stand, will make every trust account with two trustees a survivorship account as between the trustees, blindsiding the parties, given that they signed an agreement that has absolutely no language of right of survivorship, absolutely no language of ownership. In this case, his son named himself and his mother as trustees. He put her Social Security number, her tax ID number on the account. I believe what we had here, Your Honors, was some Piney Woods tax planning. I suspect, however, that in the vast majority of trust accounts with two trustees, the trustees are husband and wife, and we're dealing with community property. in such a case, an automatic survivorship right would flatly contradict Section 451-60 of our probate code dealing with community property survivorship rights.
Does that answer your question, Justice Kennedy?
Close enough.
If the lower court decision is allowed to stand, we will have a new and, I think, dangerous form of non-testamentary transfer, one that is inconsistent with the historical presumption against rights of survivorship, in derogation of the Texas statute requiring express writing to create a survivorship estate, and one that is wholly at odds with this court's decision in Stoker v. Henderson. And for these reasons, I urge this court to reverse the lower court, enter judgment that the account belongs to the estate of John Odra. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
Yes, sir. Mr. Gonzalez?
On rebuttal, you would touch on the observation by Justice, Chief Justice Brown, that the trial court's judgment in its present form should not be affirmed, but should be modified. If somebody would address that.
Yes, sir. We will. Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please report?
May it please the court, my name is Tim McKenna from Houston. I represent Stella Odra, the respondent who was the appellant for the 14th Court of Appeals, the defendant in the trial court. There was another party at one time, Michael Odra, who set forth in our brief. He's one of the named beneficiaries. He was the personal representative. He has not appeared in the trial. He was defaulted in any interest he may have had. We submit has been determined by declaratory judgment in the trial court in favor of my client. That becomes relevant if we talk about the issues of whether it's an irrevocable trust. Those issues were raised in the briefs and raised by the amicus brief that was filed. And I don't know if I'll have time to discuss that this morning. But what I am going to discuss is two things. My client takes under the probate code, if the probate code controls. My client, Ms. Odra, takes under the trust code, if the trust code controls. Mr. Johansson argues that it doesn't, it's governed by the probate code, and we've taken that position because we think it rules in our favor. But if the court were of the opinion that the probate code doesn't rule in our favor, then we'd say that this, in fact, is a trust created under the trust code. And in fact, my lady is the named grantor under the four corners of the document. And in fact, my lady is a de facto principal beneficiary with right to revoke. The majority opinion in the Court of Appeals says that's true, and that this instrument is a trust created at the time he funded it, or it was funded.
If the co-trustee of the bank, some institutional entity, the same argument would apply.
Well, I'm saying that this document, creates my lady, my client, cloaks her with grantorship ownership.
And this is a standard form card, and if the co-trustee had been a bank, for example, as is quite common, then the bank would have all of the grantor's money upon the co-trustee's demise.
I disagree. I do not believe a bank would be placing themselves on this type of instrument as the co-trustee.
If any other entity did, though, any management entity or any other entity, they would take the co-trustee's corpus, the corpus of the trust.
Well, I would have to see that particular trust and know the facts of that particular case, but my position here is this man ran an air conditioning company. He goes into this institution and does what? He sets up an account whereby he gives the ownership on the face of it to his mother. He gives the indicia of ownership to her, all rights and indicia of ownership to her, as opposed to anybody else, including himself, because I assume he presumed she was going to die before he did. Then he would control that thereafter.
Why have beneficiaries? Why not just have...
In the event she dies, he doesn't have to change the account. He doesn't have to do anything to the account. He continues to manage. When he dies, they go. But he left it to her to decide. And nobody touches upon these facts, and I think this would be an appropriate time to mention the nature of the history of this family. This man took care of his mother, took her to church every Sunday, managed her money, because that's the testimony. And we're looking at these other people that are after On February of 84, Robin asked her grandmother, if anything happens to Daddy, are you going to share this money with us? He's murdered in April. She's obviously expressing some concern over motive and responsibility. Removes the money from this account, maybe to protect yourself. Because under 439C, it would go to the beneficiaries at the end of her day.
What do you mean she's expressing concern about motive and responsibility?
Well, because that murder's never been solved.
I just don't know what you're suggesting.
Well, I'm suggesting her state of mind as to why she did what she did. She's been holding on the bulk of this money ever since that time, trying to determine if she had the right to do it as she chose. Now, she spent some of the money. It's not all there. They're suing her for over $200,000 more than is left.
The account's not the $400,000.
Oh, it's $500,000+, but they're suing her for $750,000 because they're asking for interest from the date of his death, even though she had the right to possess, and Chopin says she has no interest from that date. They're suing her for $125,000 in attorney's fees, and she didn't get any in the trial court. They're seeking a judgment from this court for over $750,000 against their grandmother, except Michael's not. And the reason, why did John do this? Why did John do this? Why did he give his mother?
Before you get into that argument, would you address your argument a little bit further that it's a gift when the jury found against you on this issue?
Well, there's no evidence in the record. It's not. I've cited a case that says
But it was your burden. If your argument was that this was a gift.
Well, it's not my burden, Your Honor. The burden under the Sumner versus Bogart case says it, this court ruled in that case, cited in my brief, that there's a presumption of gift in favor of my lady. And they had to rebut it with evidence. They offer no evidence.
But the jury found no gift.
But the jury found it, but there's no evidence in the record. There's no evidence in the record. That is my third or fourth position. My first position is that I've handed out a copy to you of the probate code, the Texas is existing in 84, a copy of one page comparing the uniform code to the Texas code. You can't see it on this exhibit. But the Texas code deleted the requirement that trust accounts be governed by the joint account language in 439F. They specifically took it out. This is one page handout I've given you. It's behind the Texas Act. And I'm saying,
so what you're really arguing is that what we said in Stoker v. Henderson is not we didn't mean it or it does not apply.
It doesn't apply for this case. Because this case says, if you'd adopted the Uniform Probate Code, it said if there's the death of one or two trustees, let's go back to Section A. The legislature wiped that whole clause out. And they want to say, well, let's go down to D, because they must have meant D in case of one or two. Well, if they meant it, do that in case of one or two, they could have simply left it in the statute. But they took it out of the statute. And I'm saying that the presumptive rule of law, as cited by the Isbell case, and 438C says my lady's presumptive owner is a trustee under the probate code. As against the world. The only person who can test that is her son, who did not. And upon his death, she's the remaining trustee. And any money left in that account when she dies goes to the beneficiaries. Now, they want to argue that 447 doesn't apply because that's to protect banks. Protect banks from what? Justice Cornish, in his opinion, Bandy talked about that. But that's to protect banks when they pay somebody. 447 says you cannot pay in a trust account. You cannot pay the beneficiary. You cannot pay the personal representative of a party. Unless you prove that the trustee is dead. Now that is a different rule in my view. So I believe the majority was right with regard to its interpretation of 438C, 439, and excluding 439D. Justice Brown wants to use 439D when the model code didn't use 439D to take care of this situation. The model code used 439C and 438C. There are no Texas trust account cases except, I think, the three I've cited. I have submitted another case with my handout, just found. It's out of the state of Illinois appellate court. The appeal was denied by the Supreme Court of Illinois. I think is pretty close on point to our facts. It was an account set up by husband and wife with his supposed money for the benefit of his children from a previous marriage. He died, the children came in and said, that's our money. She wasn't the settlor, she wasn't the grantor. It's his money, it's irrevocable to us, or it's our money up under his estate. The Court of Appeals in Illinois said, no, she's the surviving trustee with the right to revoke. As she withdrew, she revoked it. And that is the specific language granted in this account card to my client as the grantor named in the account card, to revoke as she withdraws. That Hilliard case is directly on point. In that case, the wife got the money because they said the trust owned the money in that case. They said it wasn't a bank account, although it was argued that by both sides, which we're arguing here. They said, well, really it is a trust. The trust estate took it out of his estate, as Justice Enoch was pointing out earlier. It's in the trust estate. That's our second position. If it's in the trust estate, his estate can't take it. And then if it's in the trust estate, who can take it out? The document says my client can take it out and appropriate it to her own use by revoking it as she withdraws.
Aren't you confusing the power to take with ownership?
Well, if you read the document, it says revocation. The grantor can revoke, and she was revoking as she withdrew. And that's what the Hilliard case clearly says. You revoke by withdrawing. And she revokes by withdrawing. And they say, well, you can't revoke. The Texas Trust Act says you can delegate the power to revoke, section 112.033. You can revoke. You can delegate the power to revoke. She had the power to revoke. She had the power. She had a power of appointment. She was the power to designate donees. She had a power to amend or alter. All these powers were delegated to her. If it is a trust. And if it is a trust, under the Hilliard case, we take because it's a revocable trust. It was not irrevocable on his death. There was a jury issue submitted. Did John intend it to be irrevocable on his death? And they answered no. No. The document says in five places it's revocable for both until her death. Now, you know, the trust law says you should not supplant what the testator intended. You should supplement, not supplant. For this court to take out from her the mantle of ownership that he gave her, to take off of her the mantle of grantor that he gave her, would to be to supplant his obvious intention from the four corners of the document. And if parole is not admissible, where is the evidence on anything to dispute my client's claim if parole is not admissible? We say, therefore, that under the probate code, the reasoning of the majority is correct. The legislature deleted the requirement that trust accounts be governed by Section A, 439A. Why? They don't need to be. Under the trust code, my client owns the money because she's the grantor named by him with the power to revoke. Whether she put it in there or not, we deny that for purposes of this argument that we don't maintain that he gave it to her. Back in 82, she testified to that. Put my name on it, gave it to me, said, Mama, this money is yours. Anything ever happens to me.
Isn't there some testimony that when she signed that card, she did not know what she was signing in the first place? And furthermore, whether or not it was a gift, didn't she not testify that she did not think this was a gift?
Well, I don't recall that testimony, and I'll take a look, but she did testify. He brought her the card and said, sign here. That she intended to do what he asked her to do. She did testify to that. She said, I didn't know what the card said. I did what he told me to do.
Was there evidence that he managed her money?
Yes, she testified to that.
Was there any evidence that this might have been her money that he had managed?
Well, she said that they mixed and commingled their money. She said that he had earned money over the years and that this was money that he had earned, but she also said they mixed their money. I don't think the evidence is clear whether all of this money came from him or not.
The petitioner says it's undisputed that it is.
No, I don't admit
that. What is the evidence that it wasn't?
Well, she testified that he gave it to her. That's some evidence, and she testified they mixed and commingled their money. That's some other evidence.
Was it her testimony that he gave it to her at the time they created this trust? Or
well, she actually used the time before that. See, this account was set up in 1982. With a check from Gibraltar Savings, naming them both co-trustees. They went into Mainland Savings and opened this account. Mainland's now defunct. But they went into Mainland Savings and opened this account. It was the first account they ever had there. There's some language about what the bank officer testified about what his intention was. Now, whether we're going to go into his intention or not, his intention favors my client. But that's what the bank officer testified about. He intended to leave the money to his mother for her control. Now,
counsel, this is your 5-minute warning.
Thank you, Judge.
Let me ask you, though I know you are concerned, obviously, with the facts of this case, what your response is to Mr. Johansson's argument that we're going to make every trust account an account with the right to survivorship if we uphold the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Well, I think that's what the intention of the act is, but I don't think you have to get to that. I think you can decide this case based on my argument under the trust that argument I'm making, on the grantor argument that the Court of Appeals made. I don't think you need to get to that issue at all. But this particular document, statute doesn't say you got to prove survivorship and trust accounts. The statute sets forth a statement in 439C that when the trustee dies, the money goes. Doesn't say if there's survivorship language. It says the trustee dies, the money goes to the beneficiary. It also says the survivor of two or more. Now, does that make sense if you believe their argument? One man dies, wait a minute, does the trust continue? Second man dies 2 weeks later. Does the beneficiary get the money? Does the estate of the first guy get some money, but the estate of the second guy gets no money? The mere fortuity of which person dies, A or B dies first, determines whether A gets his estate gets the money or B's estate gets the money. I submit that the legislature intended 439C to simply say trust accounts belong to trustees like 438C, and when the last one dies, whatever's left goes to the beneficiary. Now, there's some talk about the legislative history and what the legislature intended. There is only one statement, as I could find in the legislative history, about these types of trusts in a report to the committee, and it said the law is unclear. They cite the Fleck versus Baldwin case, a case from this court in 1943, a 50-year-old case that says we don't have these kinds of bank accounts in this state, where you can maybe own it and maybe give it on your death. We don't have gifts to take effect in the future. So the legislature created a whole section that allows gifts to take effect in the future. These are non-testamentary transfers under 439, 438, 450. I cited the Dickerson case where they allowed a note to be transferred as a gift to take effect in the future. If one person died, then it was payable here. They said that's not a will. It's not testamentary. It doesn't govern by the probate code except under here. It's a non-testamentary transfer. It's a gift to take effect in the future. And I'm suggesting that my client was either gifted in advance or was cloaked with all indicia of a gift to take effect either before he died or after he died. With her power to revoke and power to withdraw, would be a determinable gift that the Chopin case says you can have, a determinable gift that she applies and appropriates to herself. There are a lot of ways this court could rule in my client's favor without touching the statute. The Court of Appeals only rule on one of my 12 points of evidence. There are several comments made in my reply brief about it. But if my lady appropriates it to her own use, it's her money. According to the Hillier case, which I think is pretty much on all fours with us, with regard to that argument. One thing, finally, I want to say in closing, why did John do this? We're supposed to look at the four corners of the document. The evidence in the record is he wanted his mother to control the money. Whatever happened, it's pretty obvious that's what he intended it to happen. He wanted his mother to control it. Robin has had her trouble with the law. That's the subject of one of our conditional points of error. She's never raised these boys. Never. It's in the evidence that she has other children she's never raised. She has filed a pauper's affidavit in the Court of Appeals, in the trial court, and in this court since 1988, but most recently in June of 92, saying they can't even pay filing fees. There was over $500,000 in the estate. She filed a motion to remove Michael, alleging he embezzled the estate. Maybe that's why he's not here. I don't know. Maybe we have some insight into why Mr. John Overy didn't leave these devices to Michael or to Robert, but to his mother. I want to point out that she has stated in four or five places in the record that she intends to set up accounts for these children when this matter is over. There are conflicting claims. The claims of the estate and the beneficiaries were not settled in 1990, the morning of trial. 6 years after his death, there were conflicting claims against my client. The estate, Michael, Robin, the children, was she to pay one and not the other, get sued. When these claims are resolved, including the claims for the attorneys at 50% contingency fees, when this will happen. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear rebuttal argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Paul Clough will present rebuttal for the petitioner's argument.
May it please the court, this court should hold that John Odra's estate owns the disputed funds under Section 439D of the Texas Probate Code. That is the result required by the Probate Code, that is the holding called for by Stoker v. Henderson, and that is the decision consistent with 145 years of historical presumption against survivorship. It is also the decision that is required, we respectfully submit, by the jury findings in this case.
Justice Enoch, you had a question earlier, and you inquired about 439C, and you said, why don't the funds go to the respondent under 439C? In addition to the professor's remarks, I would indicate to you, there is no disposition, there's no language in 439C that says the funds can go to the surviving co-trustee upon the death of one trustee. It just ain't there. Let's all face it, I wish the legislature had been a little bit better and had said upon when one of two or more co-trustees dies, then the surviving trustee either gets the money or doesn't get the money. They didn't say that. What they did, however, do is they expressly provided for other cases. A governs joint accounts, B governs POD accounts, C governs trust accounts, and in the trust account provision it says when the trustee dies, and this means the sole trustee, it can't mean anything else. When you have one trustee and that trustee dies, the money goes to the beneficiary. Or if you have two or more trustees and all of the trustees die, then the funds go to the beneficiaries. The only disposition permitted under 439C is a transfer of ownership, a non-testamentary transfer under Chapter 11 of the Probate Code. It's a transfer of ownership to the beneficiaries. The respondent has absolutely no basis to claim that she gets the money as a survivor under 439C. If the legislature had intended a surviving co-trustee to get the money when one of the trustees dies, they would have said so in C. They didn't. The historical presumption in this state for 145 years has been we don't have survivorship unless the parties expressly agree to it, have a written agreement signed by the decedent. That agreement does not exist in this case. The only thing that this court can do, we submit, is to follow the language of the legislature indeed. In other cases, the death of a party to a multiple party account has no effect except to transfer the rights of ownership
to the estate. And that is exactly what would happen in the case where you and Justice Cornyn may have had a trust account together. Then your heirs, or the, as the professor says, the representative of your estate, might decide to revoke or might not. But that would be up to the estate in that case.
How about the argument that Texas Trust Act controls in this matter?
Your Honor, the account card has some language on it that says the Texas Trust Act applies, and we're creating a trust according to the Texas Trust Act. If you accept that conclusion, then you must, I think, reverse the judgment of the Civil Appeals Court and render for petitioners. Here's why. The Texas Trust Act says that to be a grantor, a settlor, or a testator, you must own the corpus. You got to own the rest. And you cannot create a trust with somebody else's money. I couldn't create a trust if I signed a deed of trust as grantor for somebody else. That wouldn't convey ownership of the property, no more than Stella Odra could sign the card as grantor. If you conclude that merely signing the card as grantor confers ownership rights upon Stella, we submit that begs the question. You have to look at the issue of whether or not she owned the money. The question as to ownership during lifetime, and again, as the professor said, right of survivorship, this court held, and there was nothing in the dissent that I understood to contradict the conclusion. In Stouffer, the court said, 439 is the exclusive means for determining survivorship in joint POD and trust accounts in Texas. If that is so, you've got to follow the statute. The majority of the Court of Appeals said, we're going to infer some right of survivorship in 438C. That is contrary to this court's holding in Stouffer v. Henderson. Beyond that, though, 438 governs ownership during lifetime, as what the statute is labeled, during the lifetime of all parties to the account. It says during their lifetimes, the beneficial rights are determined in accordance with, A, their contributions to the account. Stella didn't own the money. You know, the court asked, well, is there some evidence about whether or not Stella owned the money while she lived? I'll read you from the record, quote, and question. This is my question to Ms. Odra during the trial of the case. And even though you say that John gave you the money, your testimony to the court and jury is that you didn't earn a nickel. He, being John, earned 100% of it. He deposited all of it, and he exercised exclusive control over it during his lifetime. True? Answer, yes. I refer you to the statement of facts at 153. The evidence is undisputed that it was all John's money. But even if it wasn't, as a matter of law under 438C, because he made all the contributions to the account, this court, we think, has to hold as a matter of law, John owned 100% of the funds while he lived. Justice Gonzalez, you had inquired about the Chief Justice of the 14th Court's remark at the end of the dissenting opinion. And he says the trial court properly held, Justice Brown said, the trial court properly held that appellant did not own the funds, Stella didn't own the funds in the account. But he says the trial court should have, instead of awarding the funds 75% to us and 25% to them by the default via Michael, and we don't represent Michael, by the way, the trial court should have awarded the funds to Robin Denise Odra Stegall as successor administratrix of the estate of John Odra. That is what Justice Brown says should do, and that's the exact conclusion that we argue this court should adopt. Justice Heck, you had asked, would we have the same result if we had a co-trustee that was a bank, a lawyer, or somebody else? And absolutely. There's no reason that you can say you got a different result merely because there's some family relation or something else. Stella Odra wants to rely upon the parole evidence rule in Sheffield versus Dozier and Otto v. Clement. They want to say, well, but you can't talk about what John's intent is. But I listened to Mr. McKenna's closing arguments about what John intended when he died. It's rank speculation. This court should follow the statutory provisions. It should follow the historical presumption against survivorship. It should follow the mandate of Stouffer v. Henderson, which is survivorship is to be determined by 439 exclusively, which was the holding of this court. This court should follow the intent of the legislature when it passed 438 and 439. And when it did so, you know, the irony here, Your Honors, is that if you adopt the respondent's position, you get a result that is squarely the result of the Uniform Probate Code,
which is exactly the opposite of what the legislature intended when they passed 439. When the legislature passed 439, they deliberately changed it so that a survivorship agreement would not be inferred from the mere fact that the account is a joint account. The respondent would have you find a survivorship agreement, would have you infer one from the mere fact that the account is a trust account with co-trustees. That's the position that they would have you adopt in this case. The Sheffield versus Dozier and the other parole evidence rule cases, let me suggest to you that those are common law evidence cases whose purpose is to enforce or validate a non-testamentary transfer that complies with the probate code. The probate code says in 439 that...
Counsel, your time has expired. Are there any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument. Both of the causes today are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Audience, please rise. Oyez, oyez.